Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On part one of this special multi-part interview, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill sits down with Berkeley Law Professor Stephen Sugarman. Sugarman and his colleague Jack Koons are the historical legacy of the progressive wing of the choice movement. He discusses his start studying funding inequality, being a contemporary of conservative choice icon Milton Friedman, and the bizarre story of how the Jonestown Massacre derailed an attempt at a California ballot initiative expanding education choice spearheaded by the political left. All that and more on this episode of Podcast Ed. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
So I'm thrilled today to have Steve Sugarman with us. Professor Sugarman is a distinguished professor at UC Berkeley in the law school, and really is a historic figure in the Ed Choice movement. He's been really one of the founders of the movement, very influential. He and Jack Koons together have had a huge influence on the movement, and it's really an honor, Steve, to talk to you today.
Well, my pleasure to talk with you, Doug. Thank you very much.
So I thought it would be fun to start a little bit with history. How did you and Jack Koons get started in the Ed Choice movement? I know it had some background in school finance. Do you mind giving us that history?
When I was a student of Jack's, he was then a professor at Northwestern, and I was a law student, and he was trying to understand why it was that the kids who went to school in the wealthy suburbs had so much more resources for their education than children in the low-income suburbs. And so I set to work to study this in Illinois and then around the rest of the country. And we learned, it was well known to others, but we learned that since we had for funding public schools with local property taxes, if you had a lot of property wealth per pupil, you could pretty easily raise money you needed for good schools, or at least high spending schools. And if you had very little property wealth per pupil, no matter how high you taxed yourselves, you just couldn't come up with nearly as much money. So it's clear that there was an advantage to wealthier school districts. We started demonstrating this, showing its historic evolution. You know, it's one thing in the 1800s when an education meant building the same wooden schoolhouse. But as things developed, school districts got to be very different from each other. So we mounted a legal attack on this, what we called wealth discrimination. We said the education of children should not be a function of wealth other than the wealth of the state as a whole. It shouldn't depend on their own personal family wealth, and it shouldn't depend on the wealth of the district in which they live. And we argued before the California Supreme Court in a case called Serrano versus Priest that this was unconstitutional, and the court agreed with us. And this set off a whole bunch of litigation elsewhere in which we consulted considerably around the country challenging education funding of traditional public schools. Unfortunately, when a case got to the United States Supreme Court, at least unfortunately for us, we lost 5-4 in the case called Rodriguez against San Antonio Unified. And but this was turned out not to be the end of the litigation effort, because California's court said, well, it may not violate the federal constitution, the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. It does violate the California constitution. And this idea that the state constitution guarantees certain kind of equity was then followed by many states. So we had this sort of revolution in litigation-led revolution in school funding. We thought it was important at that time when we first posed the litigation that we'd be able to show the judges that there wasn't just one answer if they struck down the system that we had, but there were many ways in which they could adjust the system. They could subsidize low-income districts a lot more thoroughly than they had been. We called that district power equalizing, making each district equally powerful in raising money. They could, of course, have full state funding, everybody exactly the same, or it could be based upon differences from about kids, but not based upon wealth, as Hawaii does, only Hawaii does that. They could draw the boundaries of school districts to make them roughly equal to each other in wealth and then let them do what they want. Or they could decide to fund families to help them with the education of their children. And we call that family power equalizing, to give even low-income families the power to get good schools for their kids, even if they didn't have much family income. This interest in family power equalizing as a strategy for school finance reform got us to thinking about school choice more generally. Because one thing we noticed was that if you were well off, what you probably did was not send your kids to private schools, although some did that, maybe 2 or 3% of private non-religious schools. If you weren't religiously motivated to send your kid to a religious school in those days, almost all the private schools that were religious schools were Catholic schools, and about 10% of the nation's school population were in such schools. If you didn't send your child to a Catholic school, and if you didn't send your kid a few small percentage to a private non-religious school, what you did was you moved out to the suburbs. And you moved out to, if you're wealthy, to wealthier suburbs. And then you, in effect, had your little enclave of wealthier people being able to spend a lot more on their children. And if you were low income, the problem was, of course, these public schools were free, but you had to buy into the community, and the people obviously couldn't afford to live. So we had low-income families were boxed out, and they certainly couldn't afford the tuition of the traditional private non-religious schools. Now, faith-based schools, Catholic schools particularly, were very inexpensive in those days. They had largely free labor in those days, nuns mainly, and some priests who were brothers, various orders, who taught for almost nothing. They traditionally saved up money to build the school before they opened it, so they didn't have a lot of capital costs associated in. And they had large classes, so they were able to run their schools sort of on the cheap, but of course, it only appealed to a certain set of families. So we got interested, well, what about we should try to figure out ways to empower families to have a lot more choice? Well, getting access, breaking open access to the suburbs was a possibility, the rich suburbs, but we thought that was a big step that might be politically very difficult to achieve. Although at one point we did propose that if you wanted public funding, you'd be able to use taxpayers' property taxes or fund your schools, even in the wealthy suburbs. You had to have at least 20% of your kids to be from low-income families. Or at least you had to set aside at least 20% of your slots for low-income families. And then you go out and recruit them. This would be suburban schools recruiting low-income families to try to beat a number in order to get funding, both local funding and state funding, for their own public schools. This never politically caught on, but I thought it reflected our judgment that what we really need to do is to provide equal educational opportunity of sort to low-income families, which we certainly have. So then we thought, well, maybe we should work on getting families access to private schools or maybe new schools, new public schools that could be formed. They wouldn't be tied to district financing. They could be formed by the state or in any event funded by the state on a kind of uniform basis. Now, we didn't call those charter schools, but that's what they are called today, schools that are not geographically assigned, but are open to families who want to go there. So we had this idea of promoting family choice as a remedy to the school finance inequalities we saw through both these possibly new publicly funded schools or existing private schools, religious or not religious. We thought parents ought to be able to get to decide what they want, and if they want faith schools, fine. If they want non-faith schools, fine. So that's what we pushed. So in the 1970s, we wrote a model statute. We tried to put an initiative on the California ballot for voters to vote on. Unfortunately, there's a tragedy in Jonestown, and the congressional representative who was leading our campaign was killed. And so we didn't We didn't get the politically off the ground, but we did get intellectually and through elsewhere. Now, it turns out that Milton Friedman had at the same time been talking about school choice as a way to change the way we fund education in America. But he had a totally different concept. His view was that education benefits families, they ought to pay for it, but if they can't pay for it themselves, well, maybe they can be helped out. He didn't want to help them very generously. He wanted to close all the public schools that we have, sell them off to private actors. He thought that they could run much more efficiently. They were sort of conservative economics campaigns of his that were, had nothing to do particularly with helping low-income families. But nonetheless, we were both saying, hey, let's see if we can get change the focus to have family choice be the way in which our schools are directed, rather than having lion's share of families assigned based upon exactly where they happen to live. And in those days, the traditional public schools very solidly did that. You lived in a neighborhood, that's the school you were assigned. There weren't magnet schools and alternative schools and optional schools, the kind of choice we have in the public sector now, that didn't exist back then. By your choice of where you lived, you got what you got. And for many low-income families, particularly those who were lucky enough to get into subsidized housing, they had to find their housing first. If they had a place they could afford to live, and then they would end up in whatever school they got. And sometimes it was good and they were happy and their kids did well, and other times, no. And then they were stuck. And we thought they ought to be able to get out without having to move. And so we made various proposals, and it sort of got us involved in what became called the voucher movement.
Well, there's some fascinating history there. The Congressman Leo Ryan story is really powerful. I mean, you mentioned it briefly, but as I recall, he was a liberal Democrat from the Bay Area, and was totally bought into what you guys were doing with the ballot initiative, and he was going to be the lead person.
Yes, he was a good supporter of ours, a very solid guy, like us. I'm a Democrat, and I'm a liberal, but I think I'm interested in helping poor people. And we thought that the system we had was not serving them very well. I mean, it could have served them better, but it didn't. And so we were trying to change that. And this school choice attack was going to be a strategy to try to have them better, have low-income families better served, at least some low-income families. And he was our key actor, but unfortunately it was a tragedy. He died in the Jonestown massacre.
Yeah, it sort of changed history in one sense, because who knows what it would have passed or not, even had he lived. But having
It's interesting now when you do polls, when you see polls, you see that people of color tend to be in favor of our plan, and they're disproportionately lower income people. And sometimes the polls do separate out by income, and lower income people definitely are more. It's not surprising, because the low-income people, they look out enviously at these fancy suburbs. And the fancy suburb people, they don't want those people coming into their schools. And so they were against giving other people the choice they had, unfortunately. I think that's part of the voting realities.
And I think the relationship between you and Jack Koons and Milton Friedman is also interesting, because I've talked to Jack in the past, and he and Milton used to debate quite a bit. So it's interesting that you had sort of a progressive and a conservative wing of the Ed Choice movement. We still have that, by the way. I think we get along better today than you guys did back then, because I think there's a little more tension. But it is interesting that there was this choice movement, this empowerment of families, that had both a sort of a libertarian and a liberal progressive wing that all came together. I disagreed about the specifics, but it's hopeful that maybe someday again we can have a broad coalition of people who really put families at the center of the education choice movement.
Yes, I think one of the problems with the Friedman approach, I should make clear, at least in my view, is this. If you offer every family a few thousand dollars of a voucher to help them choose a private school, the main users of those vouchers are not going to be low-income families, because they don't have the extra money to top up that voucher. So what you're going to get is withdrawal of non-poor families from public schools and leaving poor families behind who can't afford the difference. Now, if you're going to give every family a voucher of $20,000, that's a different matter.
Right.
Then everybody can afford a good school with that. But that's not what Friedman proposed. He wanted to do it on the cheapest possible. So I think that, I don't think he was hostile to poor people. He was just not interested. That was not his focus of who he was trying to particularly help. And I think he was not attentive enough to what would be the real on-the-ground behavioral responses to his specific proposals. And indeed, when the Friedman proposal went on the California ballot, they got the signatures and put it on the California. Jack Koons and I opposed it. That went on 2 times, and we opposed it both times, and it failed both times. And we made the same argument that it's not generous enough to help out the people who really need the help. That made us unpopular among some people who think our goal here ought to be to make sure that low-income families have a chance to get their kids well educated. That ought to be the priority.